Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by our listeners, part of the community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice hosts regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support the community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. And well, there's been a lot of interesting things happening this week, both locally and around the country. So, Gus, did you want to start with some news?
Yeah, well, locally, you know, there's been a lot of going on at the University of Illinois, particularly after we had this massive Black Student Solidarity Rally. And one of the things that we've had, we were happy that has happened, is that so many different organizations on the campus have decided to start having more frank discussions about the material conditions and the issues that are going on for oppressed groups on the campus. So a few organizations invited me and other people to speak about what structural oppression means and how we need to make sure we keep the conversation around the material conditions of the working class and make sure, you know, and just understanding what the problems are at the university level that we don't see that much in other student movements across the country. You know, this idea of looking at how tuition has skyrocketed 125% over the past 2 years, you know.
Just in the last 2 years.
Yeah, just that quickly. Yeah. And then again, there's so much other stuff. And I think that actually the real number, if I'm not mistaken, from 1983 starting in 1983 is when you start seeing that heightened tuition rate where it started going up every year since 1983. I mean, just all these different things to talk about, especially in terms of the wages that, public sector workers on the campus are making are incredibly low and not matching the cost of living adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot, and then the issues with how the governor has been very, you know, very instrumental in keep and making sure the budget impasse has destroyed the lives of working people on the university campuses. So one of the things that my organization, Black Students for Revolution, wants to make sure is prevalent in these discussions is you have to look at the material conditions of oppressed groups across the working class lines. Otherwise, all these so-called demands that these student groups are making aren't gonna serve anybody but a very small percentage of the privileged middle class. And we can't have that as being something that we push for. We have to push for, real demands that improve the material conditions of all working people on these campuses.
Yeah, gosh, you know what I wish that, Black Students for Revolution was a, interest group or caucus within an overall Students for Revolution.
That's what we're hoping it turns into, actually, because I think that because I gave a talk, to UMMA, UIUC, this past week, and they're an organization that focuses mostly on religious stuff, but now they're actually starting to shift over into more political education type initiatives.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, what we're hoping is that our political education and the work that we're doing on the campus is not going to be, you know, it's going to spread out to other oppressed groups outside of just the Black students.
Mm-hmm.
That other people are going to start having real frank conversations about material conditions about all people on the campus.
Okay.
So, yeah.
As far as tuition, just to keep in context, in my lifetime, I remember when I graduated high school in 1975, full-time tuition at the U of I was $350 a week. Now, to put that in context, that was about a week and a half's take-home wages of a union tradesperson. Okay, so in today's money, if everything was constant, that would come out to about a little under $1,800 a semester. Okay, when I went to school at the U of I from 85 to 88, it was $880 a semester, which would come out, you know, doing the, you know, with inflation would come out to around $2,700. What is it now, Gus, for one semester, for undergrad? I heard it was like around close to $10,000. No, that's maybe for the year, $5,000.
No, I think it's a lot more higher than that. We're the second highest tuition school in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Northwestern is number one, and then
okay.
We're number two.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think we're actually at, I don't want to give the incorrect number because my computer is still updating,
mm-hmm.
but I believe that we're above 15,000.
For in-state or out-of-state? In-state. Yeah.
15,000 for a semester?
I think so.
Once
my computer updates,
wow, that's even worse
number,
than
but,
I thought, man.
But the thing is, and just to correct what I said earlier, is actually the 1983 period to 2015 is the 125% increase.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I just want to make sure I get the numbers right. Yeah, so tuition has gone up 125% at big universities and colleges in the United States from 1983 to 2015,
yeah.
125%. And again, that goes into what Bill was talking about last week in the sense that there was a time period in the late 70s, early 80s where you saw this attack by the federal government on working people. Because
mm-hmm.
like you say, working class people used to be able to go to college and be able to afford it
mm-hmm.
to where they didn't have to take out ridiculous loans that they'll never be able to pay back.
Yes.
Now it's at the point now where people are getting priced out of going to school.
It's become a luxury, basically.
Yeah, exactly. It's become a luxurious privilege to actually mm-hmm. be able to go to school. And it's going to be at the point in 10 years if this continues that very few people are going to be able to go to school because what you see the University of Illinois doing that other universities are probably going to start following is going overseas and having these contracts with governments to get cash money flow instead of loans and scholarships so that they can increase their profit margin.
Mm-hmm.
So the university is setting a model because of their big international student push,
mm-hmm.
you know? So that's something that people really need to start considering because what's happening is you have so many different people from the working class across racial lines who cannot get into school and who cannot afford to go to school because
yeah.
the governments overseas can pay those increased tuition hikes. But we can't.
Yeah. And let's not forget, this, the whole state of California for quite a few years had free college education, both community level and university level. And not to mention the fact that nationwide there was all sorts of, Pell grants and other types of assistance, based on income, which were basically, they started cutting those back, starting with the Reagan years. And, what little is out there anymore is either, based on, sports scholarships, and some, scholastic scholarships. But I mean, it's just, they're very, very few and hard to obtain. So,
I did find, actually, figuring out how much it costs to go to the University of Illinois is fairly complicated.
Right. Okay. You got room and board.
Support. Well, let's just say tuition.
Just tuition is complicated, and also because it's different for different colleges, different subjects, and so on.
Really?
Yeah. And are also...
Well, that's something else that's changed since... Okay.
Okay, various courses have different fees just for those courses and so on and so forth. But anyway, the most basic thing I could find that seemed to cover a very wide range of subjects and so on. Resident in what's called range one, which is 12 plus hours, which would be pretty much full-time student, $6,018 basic
for a semester.
$12,036 per year.
Right? Okay.
But plus, I mean, I think really you would be seeing $15,000 to $20,000 for most students. Tuition, basic fees of various sorts. Remember, you have activity fees too, and these things aren't optional.
Books,
housing,
medical, yeah.
How about if you need parking too?
Yeah, non-residents. Non-residents, it says it's $27,000 a year.
Okay.
And international is over $28,000 per year.
Okay, that must be a total thing because here they have just for the tuition, non-resident is $13,000, about $600. And international is just about a little over $14,000.
Yeah, that's per semester, and this is per year.
Okay. Well, that's something else that changed because I remember it used to be almost double for an international student, and about one and a half times for a out-of-state student. So, the differential
is over double now. Yeah.
Okay, here's something. Number one, as we said before, if you look at the buildings up at the tops, you'll see in there carved learning and labor, which is the motto of the university, which is a reflection of the time of which the university was created.
A public land grant college, yep.
You know, similar to their teaching of a subject called rhetoric, which when they started teaching basically English composition, rhetoric was about writing. You know, it wasn't about, persuasion or so much. It's really weird how a lot of these universities and their customs are rooted in things 100 years ago or more when they were founded. But the thing is at the U of I, this is like about 20 years ago, I think maybe me and Peter Miller were standing, Peter Miller, founder of this program. I think we had attended a speech by the current president of the AFL-CIO. God, I can't believe his name's escaping me. I'm drinking too much probably.
Sweeney?
Yeah, no, not Sweeney.
Lane Kirkland?
No. The current guy who's president now.
Oh, the guy who's president now, Trumka.
Trumka, yeah. Richard Trumka. Yeah. And I think you were even there, Dave. Staley workers were there.
I wasn't there. I couldn't make that one. I heard about it though. I heard it got a little, fiery.
Yeah. But anyway, Richard Trumka, and I'm always criticizing people for not knowing his name. Anyway, we were standing right in front of the building afterwards and, we're kind of discussing these issues and I said, Peter, watch the traffic that comes by here. Okay, so what comes by? A BMW, a Mercedes-Benz, a Volvo, a Harley-Davidson with a guy sporting about $5,000 worth of leather. You know, and you could see in the cars and on the motorcycles, these were students. And that was 20 years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, moving on to some news stories. Bob, you have an interesting update on, you want to... Well, I'll just let you take off with it because we talked about this before on the show.
Yeah, we did several years ago. This is out of Charleston, West Virginia, and it says here, a jury finds Don Blankenship guilty on misdemeanor charge, not guilty on felony charges. If you recall, Don Blankenship was the CEO of Massey Energy, and this occurs basically going back to the Upper Big Branch mine disaster in West Virginia when 29 people got killed. And it says... after 6 weeks of testimony and 10 days of deliberation, the jury handed down a guilty verdict on the misdemeanor conspiracy charge. The jury says he was guilty of conspiring to willfully violate mandatory mine health and safety standards. Like I say, they found guilty, or they found Blankenship not guilty on the two felony charges, making false statements to a government agency, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, and securities fraud. The prosecuting attorney, U.S. Attorney Booth Goodwin, says to his knowledge the conviction is unprecedented. He says it's the first time he's aware of that a chief executive of a major corporation has been convicted of a workplace safety crime. And it says here, Blankenship could face up to a year behind bars for the conviction when he is sentenced in March. Goodwin says the conviction is long overdue. A lot of people came out praising this. Thursday afternoon, the United Mine Workers of America and International President Cecil E. Roberts issued the following statement saying, a measure of justice has been served through the conviction of Don Blankenship on federal charges of conspiring to violate mine safety standards. The truth that was common knowledge in the coal fields that Don Blankenship cared little for the safety and health of miners working for his company and even less for the laws enforcing their rights has finally been proven in court. It says here, however, he also says this decision will not bring back the 52 people killed on Massey Energy property during Blankenship's reign as the head of that company, including the 29 that were killed at the Upper Big Branch disaster in 2010. Their families must live without their loved ones holding their grief in their hearts the rest of their lives. Now, some of the families were thrilled that he was found guilty. They said, we just wanted to hear the word guilty come out of it. But I would say the majority of the families responded and said that they wanted to see him guilty on all three charges, you know. So the views and opinions expressed here are those of me. and I'm going to say, I bet you when his sentencing comes up in March, he's found with probation. And time, he won't serve any of that possible 1 year in jail. And it's just a shame that he was found not guilty on the two felonies like that, because he obviously lied to the Mine and Safety and Health Administration like that, and securities fraud, too. And it's just a shame. 52 people had been killed when he was the CEO of that company, 29 in one particular disaster.
Yeah, and it wasn't like it was an act of God. It was because of his willful violation of safety rules and stuff.
They used to tell people, you know, when the inspectors were coming and they would change everything around so it looked good so they could pass the inspections, and he just, you know, outright lied to people. So anyway, you know, some good, at least they found misdemeanor guilty charges, but in my mind it was far too little.
Reason I was started laughing there, I was working for a contractor at the State Farm Center, and one day OSHA showed up. They pulled all of us off and said, if anybody asks you why we're pulling off, we're having a safety meeting. And then they sent everybody home, because the best way to not be caught by OSHA is to not be there.
I see. Yeah.
And this was the safest company I've ever worked for. That was so paranoid about this. Yeah. But another thing I would throw in here, I can't find it, but I do believe that I saw earlier this week about a bill introduced by Republicans, of course, which would absolve all corporate officers from any personal liability from any crimes committed by their corporation.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I may be wrong, but I remember seeing that. Maybe I'm having a Donald Trump moment here, and there was, you know, okay, you know, with the cheering Muslims or something.
Yeah.
The best memory.
Yeah. Gus, what were you going to say?
The cheering Republicans in the streets.
But yeah, this is Bob's story is very reminiscent of the story that we also talked about in the auto industry,
right,
where that car company, I forget which one it was, where they had
those VW safety, out of Germany, right?
Yeah, they had those safety issues.
Lying about the environmental stuff.
Yeah, and diesel engines.
Right. And those people, and so many people were killed because of that, and there was and nobody has been, like, subpoenaed or charged with any type of crime.
It's a corporate state. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is corporations control our government.
You're talking about the GM ignition switch incident, right?
About torpedoes.
Yeah. Pino gas tanks and,
cruise control.
Yeah.
Oh, their foot slipped.
Well, that leads into my new story, is that skilled trade workers at Volkswagen in Chattanooga voted yes to representation by the United Auto Workers. I could think of maybe a better union they could have picked, but anyway, after the UAW lost a vote among hourly workers in February 2014, skilled trade workers chose to hold their own election. Friday night, the workers voted 108-44 in favor of union representation. 10 of the workers did not not participate. This means UAW will act on behalf of the skilled workers as a bargaining representative pending certification of the election by the National Labor Relations Board. VW officials were not in favor of the move. However, the NLRB gave the green light for the second vote, citing a large community interest as the reason. VW spokesman Scott Wilson says the automaker plans to file an appeal with the NLRB, hoping they'll reconsider its decision to separate maintenance and production workers and allow them to vote as an entire group for union representation. The skilled trades that vote for inside the plant that voted for representation at the Chattanooga facility make up 11% of VW's workforce.
Oh, by the way, Dave, got something here.
Yeah.
About my own union. My president, Terry, oh, they used to call him Terrence.
Yeah.
But this press release has Terry O'Sullivan. That's because Terry is one of the guys.
Yeah.
You know, when he's out on the golf course.
It's Terrence. Yeah.
He's probably, maybe he got the previous president's Arthur Coyas, maybe he inherited the Clinton golf clubs. That was a big one back in the 90s. They were so chummy with the Clintons and they got golf club, or they gave the Clintons golf clubs or something. I don't know. But anyway, Terry O'Sullivan, general president of Labor's International Union of North America, made the following statement today, and this is November 6th, actually, regarding the administration's decision on the Keystone XL pipeline, a decision that I wholeheartedly support myself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Quote, President Obama today demonstrated that he cares more about kowtowing to green-collar elitists than he does about creating desperately needed, family-supporting, blue-collar jobs. After a seven-year circus of cowardly delay, the president's decision to kill the Keystone XL pipeline is just one more indication of the utter disdain and disregard for the salt of the earth, middle-class working Americans. The politics he has played with their lives and livelihoods is far dirtier than oil carried by any pipeline in the world, and the cynical manipulation of the approval process has made a mockery of regulatory institutions and government itself. We are dismayed and disgusted that the president has once again thrown the members of LIUNA and other hard-working blue-collar workers under the bus of his vaunted, quote, legacy, while doing little or nothing to make a real difference in global climate change. His actions are shameful. Now, I do have to say I sort of agree with doing little or nothing about climate change, but the Keystone XL pipeline, I'm telling you right now, as far as laborers go, there would be a job there for several dozen laborers.
For the whole project?
Yeah, maybe 100, 200.
Okay.
And those would not be, what would happen is that it goes through locals.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be about half of those laborers will stay with the company and go from local to local.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the number in the contract is specified something like 35.
Mm-hmm.
And then what they'll do is they'll hire about a matching number of that from each local they go through.
Along the route of the pipeline.
And, right. Uh-huh. And you may have anywhere, if you start out with the clearing crew, all right, and then are able to drop back on your little stretch of the pipeline, then you might have a job for several months, and you'll make really, really good money. Mm-hmm. But this isn't like they were talking about. What my representative, I guess our representative in Congress, last winter he's talking about the 40,000 job study. You know, there's going to be, it turns out there's going to be 35 permanent jobs. People just, basically maintaining, pumping stations and, you know, checking out the pipeline, making sure everything's working right. That's it. This is just ridiculous.
I mean, for the number of jobs, gee, I mean, it'd be nice to hear Terrence O'Sullivan come out with that kind of vigor, and enthusiasm, like when Obama refused to support the card check system right after labor helped get him elected in 2008.
Right.
It'd have been nice to hear him come out and say this sort of thing against the scam that is the Affordable Care Act.
Hold on, and on and on,
you know.
All right. Now here, I do have to say at the end of the press release, I do have some agreements with him.
Okay.
From his decision.
So you didn't agree with any of that previous statement?
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay.
except for doing little or nothing to make a real difference in global climate change.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
But anyway, from his decision on the Keystone XL, which I agree with Obama mm-hmm. on that, to the attack on quality health care through the so-called Cadillac tax, to his efforts to ship good jobs overseas to the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Oh, yes. Another one he could have come out with, yes.
Barack Obama. Well, Dave, he might have come out really strong against it, but nobody's going to report it.
I see.
You know, I didn't know about it. I just happened to find this press release by accident. This is actually on the union's website.
Okay.
That's another thing right there, Richard Trumka. Just like I said, why is not the representative of the largest labor group in this country not being seen in the same media spaces as you will see representatives for the National Association for Manufacturers from ALEC, but of course at least half the Congress is representatives of ALEC,
yeah.
American Legislative Exchange and all that. But anyway, that's just what I'm saying. This comes back to culture. I know I talk about that a lot,
mm-hmm.
but it is really skewed in that manner,
yep.
where it's bizarre. The thing that makes up the most of your life, maybe outside of your immediate family, your work, one of the most important things to every person in this country who is a working person, which is the vast majority of the people of this country, gets incredibly short shrift compared to other topics.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, every newspaper used to have they call it a labor beat
right,
reporter. Yeah. I remember, you know, here in the local newspaper, every time a union local would have a vote for their new executive board, it'd be in the paper with their photographs, you know.
But I now mean, if it is in the paper.
It's not even, yeah,
if it is, it's in the business section.
Yeah, and it's usually a negative story, of course.
Yeah, and, of course, you know, part of this may be unions on their own too. They are not so adept at the public relations. They've been really regressive in many ways in dealing with people outside of their membership. They have taken the path of simple unionship prescribed by Samuel Gompers over 100 years ago. What I would call the fail path of that, and not accounting what it is now, we have a country of mainly non-union workers who actually resent union workers quite often.
Mm-hmm.
I was dismayed the other day. There's a alternative country band called the Drive-By Truckers.
Yeah.
And I was looking at one of their CDs here and I can't remember the exact name of the song, but it was about a guy that worked at a Chrysler factory who just didn't really care about making Chryslers and blah, blah, blah. And it was a really cut down
mm-hmm.
of factory workers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where I'm going with this. It's just, I just can't believe it. It's like the world's upside down.
Where it should be, yeah.
And we should look for that song, too.
Okay. Gus, you had something else?
Yes, it's time for our monthly jobs report.
The oh, yes.
real jobs uh-huh. report that we do because, of course, the corporate media is not going to give us the real jobs report. So let's go ahead and actually show what's been happening. And what's been happening is what we've been talking about for over almost a year now is that low wage, low skilled jobs are just skyrocketing and taking up most of the job report. So the U.S. economy added 211,000 jobs in November, according to the figures released by the Department of Labor. But if you actually break down those numbers, which the corporate media does not do, official unemployment remained at 5%, while average wages for hourly private sector employees grew by a misery of 0.2%. Wages are up 2.3% from 1 year ago, which is less than the increase in the cost of living. So we still don't have wages matching the increased cost of living anywhere in the United States.
Not to mention productivity.
Of course. Construction employment rose by 46,000, while lower paid sector continued to predominate, including retail with 30,000 jobs and professional services, 27,000 jobs. The mining sector lost more than 11,000 jobs, coming to a decrease of more than 123,000 lost jobs since last December.
Wow.
So again, those blue collar, livable wage jobs continue to collapse. So this idea, forget having a middle class, the working class where you can have a livable blue collar job is completely disappearing at this point. And those retail services where you're pushing buttons all day and sweeping streets, that's what's actually getting the money now. And that's low wage, no benefit work. And that's what's predominating this so-called job recovery that the federal government is now praising, except that nobody can actually get work that can sustain a life in this country right now. So yeah, and again, there's so much more about this report classified. 1.7 million people are being marginally attached to the labor force, or individuals who were not in the labor force, wanted and were available for work and had looked for a job sometime in the prior 12 months. So these workers were not counted among the unemployed if they had failed to look for a job in the month prior to the report's release. An even higher number, 9.9 million, are stuck in part-time jobs and unable to find full-time work.
Yeah.
So you have full-time work that is sub-working class, and you have part-time work that is even below that.
Well, how many of those people might be working two or three part-time jobs
exactly.
in order to simulate full-time work without getting... If working the same hours without getting the overtime that might have been due to them.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And if they had one job.
Also, exactly. If I'm not mistaken, once somebody's on unemployment and their benefits run out, they're no longer counted as unemployed.
Exactly.
They so just disappear.
Number,
you know?
And that's always been a problem with the numbers in terms of how the Department of Labor calculates these statistics. There is such a swell of working people who are not counted in this to kind of skew the numbers.
Yep.
I mean, but they're much, even though these numbers are bad, they're much worse. I mean, in one sector, we've lost 100,000 jobs in a year. So you can imagine all the other working class blue collar jobs that have been. So if you get a chance, everybody listening, please look at the jobs report to understand that this recovery that people are praising is really very regressive. There's nothing progressive about people getting work that they cannot sustain themselves on. What it does is it places them outside of the realm of being able to get social services
yes.
to protect themselves. So they're like a few dollars above what
yep.
they couldn't get social services, and then they end up, you know, in debt or losing homes. I mean, it's just a very nasty crisis for working people in this country right now.
Yeah, and I have a really, this is amazing how these stories have kind of just related. I mean, we really didn't plan this, but I brought something here today that relates to what you're saying. Is a new EPI report examines how currency manipulation and unfair trade practices, not high wages, are behind the decline in U.S. manufacturing competitiveness. The report explains that to rebuild manufacturing without cutting manufacturing wages, the United States should learn from other countries like Germany, which is among the highest manufacturing wages while maintaining a stable share of world exports and suffering minimal manufacturing job losses. And this week's economic snapshot shows that Germany's average manufacturing hourly pay was $48.98 in 2013. That's $48.98. Yes.
Yeah. Is that total package?
Probably. Probably.
Okay.
Yeah. But remember, you know, they have a national health care.
Oh, that's right. They don't need as much of a package
exactly.
as we do.
And not only that, Bill, but they don't have private pensions. Basically, they have just Social Security,
so
which
that's
pays
basically
what
their that's going
wage
into
was
their
when
pocket.
They worked.
It's
yeah.
not like with us, where my total package is like probably $60 an hour, but you know,
you're getting 50. Half that, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, this is this hourly manufacturing wage in Germany is 1/3 higher than in the U.S., yet Germany's manufacturing sector has remained stable in the face of competition from China, while the U.S. has lost 5.4 million manufacturing jobs since 1997, basically 3 years after the enactment of the North American Free Trade Agreement, and a couple years later when they enacted the China Preference Trade Treaty Act. If higher wages hurt manufacturing competitiveness, we would expect Germany to be doing worse than the U.S. So, you know, again, you know, lies, lies, and more lies. You're being fed by the corporate media and underreporting or not reporting relevant news out there that really affect the average American.
There's several different unemployment rates that are reported. The one that Gus and most of the media always focuses on is the U3 unemployment rate, and that's strictly what does it say? It's the official unemployment rate. U5 also includes discouraged workers and all other marginally attached workers. and U6 adds on those workers who are part-time purely for economic reasons.
Oh, okay.
And U6 is sometimes quoted, and this is kind of where more Gus is leading with his stuff. That's still at 9.9% here as of November, so it's almost double.
It's almost double,
What they officially report, you know, and that includes a lot more of what we're talking about here, the discouraged workers, long-time unemployed, and people that are working part-time when they would really like to work full-time. So,
yeah, okay, we're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Listen Support Community Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois, and you're listening to the World Labor Hour here, and we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line, a flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him, the VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. That big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills. But they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot. Cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack. Just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the square. There's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. The bar's still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd gets thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit.
Okay, we're back. This is the World Labor Hour broadcast on WFT, Listen Support Community Radio Station, Champaign, Illinois. That was James McMurtry. We can't make it here anymore. And got some public service announcements here. The anti-war, anti-racism effort of Champaign-Urbana is having its monthly demonstration at the corner of Neal and Main Street in downtown Champaign from 2 to 4 p.m. They have this every first Saturday of the month. And if you're interested in getting involved with the anti-war and racism effort, otherwise known as AWARE, they have meetings every Sunday at 5 p.m. at the Cafeteria and Company Restaurant in downtown Urbana, 208 West Main. And also they have a weekly broadcast on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6, AWARE on the Air, which broadcasts on Tuesday. And if you'd like to join them, it's open to anybody who'd like to participate. And that's broadcast from live from noon to 1 on Tuesdays and then rebroadcast in the evenings on Comcast Channel 6, Urbana Public Television. Today, this evening, actually, there's going to be a rock out for the lockout fundraising event for locked out Clifford Jacobs workers. That's from 5 to 8 p.m. with dinner and musical entertainment. And that'll be at the Plumbers and Pipe Fitters Union Hall, which is South Neal, Route 45. And try to make it out for a good cause and also some good music by live music by the Killer Bee Honey is the name of the band. And there's going to be food actually catered there and everything. And I can't announce in the air the cover charge, but it's very reasonable. Just let everyone know. Today and every Saturday from 2 to 3 p.m. is None Other Sports Show with host fellow worker Neil Parthen on WRFU 104.5. Tune into that. Very interesting perspective on the world of sports from a political labor view. And I think Gus was on the show a couple weeks ago, weren't you?
Yeah, it was excellent. Yeah, we talked about the impact of the student movements. We talked about a lot of issues in terms of domestic violence and foundational American culture in sports. And, you know, I mean, so it was an amazing show. And Neil, like I said, you know, he's one of the best radio show host I've ever been around. Like, he's so knowledgeable. He's so good at what he does. So it's a really amazing show if you never listened to it.
Okay. Yeah.
You need to listen.
So tune into that every Saturday, including this Saturday from 2 to 3, at WRFU 104.5. And coming up, Labor's Worldview TV tomorrow and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. Tomorrow, is going to be the documentary on the United Electrical Workers, Workers Republic, about the occupation and takeover of the Republic Windows and Doors factory in Chicago 2008 by rank and file members of the UE union. And since that happened in 2008, they've eventually, the workers now own the plant. Interesting story. It's a really good documentary. And the following Sunday on December 13th is the 2008 GEO strike, a one-day strike. Very good film footage about that during that strike, and also an interview with one of the participants. And the following Sunday on the 20th is a history of U.S. government subversion of democracies around the world since the end of World War II. And on Sunday, December 27th, is a segment about Venezuela, showing film segments from the film The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, which documents the attempted short-lived CIA-backed coup against Hugo Chavez, and interview a local Urbana woman who lived in Venezuela at the time. And just to let you know what's coming up here on the World Labor Hour radio program, next Saturday, live in the studio will be local resident Nancy Dietrich to talk about Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, Climate Versus Capitalism. And the following week, on the 19th, we're having Paul Simons will call in from New York City to talk about the successful pro-worker, pro-feminist resistance against ISIS in Rojava, Syria. And then later on January 2nd, Gerald Freeman, University of Massachusetts economist, known for his research showing the huge cost savings that single-payer Medicare for All would save both working people and individual state governments, will call in. On January 9th, live here in the studio, we'll have Gus's professor and advisor, Professor Sundiata Chajua. And we got some other interesting stuff coming up, too, in that month of January. So stay tuned. We're trying to bring you some very, we both try to do a mix of local and national, international stories for you, because frankly, I mean, this is what working people need to be aware of, is what's going on in their workplace and in their community, but also need to know what's happening around the country and around the world. That's what we're trying to do here, folks. And if you have any suggestions for guests and upcoming programs, feel free to contact us. We're going to open the phone lines now. You can call
Dave.
In. Hold on just a second, Bill. We're opening up the phone lines now at 217-3-FLY LIVE.
Okay, how would people contact us?
You can contact us at my email address at davidjohnson1451@comcast.net.
There you go. Thank you.
Okay. You can also check out our Facebook page as well.
Facebook page. And you might catch us immediately after the show if you're lucky.
Indeed. And we're
at 359-9338.
Yes. And we're at 113 North Market Street, downtown Champaign. And we always love it when people come down after the program, 12 noon. And we've had that happen often. And love to hear, see you in person and meet you and stuff. So feel free to drop in sometime.
Please.
So, what else is going on, guys, that you'd like to talk about?
Local iron worker went on a rampage lately.
Okay.
And according to people, what happened was, the man went to a house in a town called St. Joseph, east of Champaign, shot somebody with a shotgun. There were a few people in the house. Then left. He eventually stole a couple of vehicles, held some people at gunpoint, who I think were probably just people remodeling an apartment in Mahomet, from the story, for a couple of hours and told, oh, here we go. But anyway, he was a local iron worker. People who worked with him said he was a quiet guy. What else is new when it comes to
Indeed.
Rampages?
Okay. Hello, WFT. You're on the air.
Jim Iman.
Hi, Jim.
Okay. The report today is that the so-called socialist, Francois Hollande, has, as of Friday, he's demanded that all people with mixed citizenship, who are French citizens, but also citizens of another country, all of them their citizenship in France will be taken away from them.
Wow.
Now, this affects my family personally.
Oh, it does.
You know, my ex-wife and my kids, they're French citizens.
Mm. Okay.
which means they won't be allowed to vote in French elections anymore. But anyway, but, you know, what's going on in France, it's become a police state.
Indeed.
It's the worst of all of them. And they're going through Muslims' houses, no knocks, banging down doors, shooting in the ceiling. One eight-year-old girl got hit with shrapnel. She's lucky she's still alive. It's just, I mean, well, anyway. Okay, item number two. The invisible dragon at the University of Illinois is the DOD, the Department of Defense, a.k.a. the War Department, that would have thrown at least $1 billion and probably more money into the university.
Uh-huh.
So, and this I can confirm by one of my friends that works for the faculty.
Okay.
It's just, and I also talked to Aaron Ammons this morning on my round. And I said that at least we should get a resolution passed that we're welcoming Syrian refugees. So it's just, you know, what's happened in Chicago has just been all over this morning. But anyway, I'll let you go. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, a lot of things thrown out there and stuff. And by the way, folks, I want to apologize that benefit for the locked out Clifford and Jacobs is next Saturday, not this Saturday. So thank you, Bob, for pointing that out. I guess since it was sent to me, I overlooked the date on that, and I apologize. I usually try to be more thorough on that sort of thing. So that's next Saturday, and we'll give you another update next Saturday about it happening. So
we'll start calling you Ben Carson or Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, yeah.
That memory.
Yes. Well, thanks to our listeners who pointed that out to us.
Okay.
Stuff, so.
Oh, very good. Okay.
Yeah. Next Saturday starts at 5 o'clock and goes through about 11, I believe. So next Saturday.
Listeners, we got that person and Jim Iman.
There you go.
Yeah. All right. There we go.
Well, there's a lot more people out there listening than you think. That's the whole thing is that, we need to hear from you. Like I said, besides suggesting upcoming guests and programs, topics, we'd just like to hear from you in general. Not to mention, twice a year, get some financial support to help keep this program and the radio show on the air. But I'm not going to go into that. Let's go on to, Bill just talked about a recent shooting here in Champaign-Urbana. I think, Gus, you said you got some interesting stats on what's going on. Why is there so many shootings?
Well, let's be honest. I think that, and one of the things that I've been trying to talk about when we bring up this issue with violence in this country, and those that know me know this already about me, but it's just that we cannot have these political posturing conversations about gun reform and all this other stuff. And we're really going to get to the heart of understanding why so many shootings are happening at such an alarming rate. I mean, this has become really just, a friend of mine used the term Thunderdome. Seriously, at that point, we have to start thinking about this from a foundational aspect. We have to understand what is it in American culture that has created this need for violence. And if we look at the history of our country, the country's progress is linked directly to violence. Anything that we've done as a United States country and then as an American empire, when imperialism comes in, any type of progress or any type of modernism or modernity has been linked extremely to violence. And we're talking from macro level and also micro level. We're talking about neighborhoods hyper-segregating. We're talking about educational services. I mean, we're talking about things that people really don't consider to be created through violence that violence is used every single day. So again, if people are questioning, how do we stop these shootings? How do we stop this violence? And it's not just, again, when we talk about violence, we're not just talking about the mass shootings, we're talking about police brutality. We're talking about violence that comes from economic subjugation and lack of resources in different parts of the country. We're talking about so many different types of violence that it's just inherent in this culture. So the question is, we have to start not only challenging elected officials, who I don't believe give any care about the human rights of people in this country, but we have to start challenging ourselves in our communities using education to understand how violence affects our everyday life and how
was historically rooted in the founding of this country and its progress. Once we do that and we do consistent education on this, then we could possibly start re-revolutionizing or changing, transforming the culture of this country. That's really the only way that this is going to happen.
He's very right there. I mean, just look at historically how things are done, how things are done now. You don't negotiate. You never take anything off of the table. It's always like that.
Even for the ruling class.
For the ruling class. Yeah. But I mean, all the way down from the top, all the way down in this, and I'm going to bring it up again, culture in this country. Grow up. You watch the cowboy shows as a child. How are things taken care of with Marshall Dillon's gun? Okay.
That's people in our age group. Yeah.
Yes, of course. And it's not so much the violence, but it's how the violence is used.
Yes.
You could have very violent programming that would, probably get people not to want to have guns.
Right.
All right. For that point. But, it's the same thing. It's like here with this local story, with this younger, I believe he's probably maybe in his 30s or so, iron worker.
Mm-hmm.
He apparently, it looks like he had a personal problem.
Yep.
What does he do? He gets a shotgun. And this guy had already done time in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he probably should not have had access to any kind of a weapon. It's not known where he got the shotgun, or at least it's not mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just it. From the top down, from what we're going to do about a foreign situation, down to how we deal with
a personal
our friends,
problem.
A personal problem.
And that's exactly what is key. Bill said it right on, he put it right on point that when, I'm talking about from our beginnings in history all the way up to present day, whenever there has been a personal dispute or some type of profit or some type of gain that we wanted, we use violence in this country. And that's always been the norm. So this idea of trying to retard that norm and trying to reform it in the current system is illogical. There has to be a breakdown of that norm, not necessarily a reform of it, but an actual deconstruction and then a reconstruction of something different. Because, I mean, Bill said it perfectly. People really think in those terms if you think of it from a psychological standpoint. When there's a problem that they feel like they cannot handle, they say that I'm going to overpower another human being. I'm going to use violence to get what I want. That's something that was born in this country. I mean, other countries have had violent histories as well, but none of them were born and progressed solely through violence.
You know, the first time I went to Germany with my wife after we were married, this was in the late 70s, one thing that struck me, I remember it was around Christmas time, we're going through toy stores, and it was actually a section of a store that had toys for kids. You know, a very tiny section of the whole toy store section had, any kind of military related toys.
Well, I mean,
we're here going to like the boys section of a toy store. I mean, that seems like all you see is military and various that type of related toys for boys.
Look at all the computer games out there and the PlayStation games. And I would say that 75% of those are based on violence. You know,
yes, yes.
Grand Theft Auto. You know, I mean, that's really not as violent as some of the others. But you know, I mean, it's about stealing cars.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's say you grow up in Germany. All right, I don't know. Are you going to play Teutons and Romans? You know, wouldn't that be the analog to cowboys and Indians?
I guess, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's children's play in the United States is based on war.
Yeah.
The play is. Yes. Not just media, not just games, video games, but the very act of play. And we played Army all the time when I was a kid. We loved it. And we had these guns. But then on the other hand, I haven't gone on a mass shooting spree either.
Yeah. Well, neither have I. And I've been a gun owner since I was 18 years old and used to go fire target practice with my father, you know.
And that's why we can't necessarily look at strictly consumerism, which is what a lot of the liberals like to do, is like strictly consumerism. They don't like to look at the past.
Root problem.
Yeah, they don't like to look at imperialism. They don't like to look at the Mexican-American War, Manifest Destiny. They don't like to look at the slave trade and its sharecropping.
Yes.
And, of course, you know, most violent murders during that time period against African-Americans and other white working-class people, was over labor disputes.
Yep.
You know? And like I said, I mean, we have to really – complicate how we talk about the root of violence in this country.
And what, and the inequality in this country, the poverty. I mean, you know, like in, it's not just inner cities, by the way. It's also out on certain Indian reservations and also in Appalachia. When you got people that are desperate, that don't have jobs, need money, they turn, a lot of times they'll turn to the illegal drug trade. Well, what happens if, you know, you get into a dispute with another group or that somebody owes you money and stuff? You can't go and file a police report or take them to small claims court. It's settled by it's settled by guns ultimately, you know, and that's, you think about it, it's not the guns that's causing that, it's the money. And it's not the drugs that's causing it. It's the money behind the drugs. And it's because these people have no other opportunities to go by. So you throw that into the mix. And then, you know, then there's, like you're talking about, Gus, this whole thing about, I saw a thing on Facebook the other day, by the way, about a man down in, I think it was Alabama, or Mississippi, that went into a Waffle House restaurant and the waitress told him it was a non-smoking restaurant because he lit a cigarette, went outside, got a gun, came in and killed this waitress.
Yeah.
I mean, are you kidding me?
Yeah. I mean, and again, that's normal for American society, because when you had an issue, like, we can go back to the history of duels.
I mean,
seriously, like, this is something that was considered to be, like, if you were felt disrespected, you would have a duel with somebody until somebody was dead. I mean, and then again,
well, Ted Cruz wanted Obama to say whatever it was to his face.
Yeah.
Just recently. I can't remember what it was, but he felt insulted by something Obama said. He wanted to say it to his face.
Oh, well.
Like he was going to punch him.
Yeah, sure. Sure he will,
you know? Ted. So like I said, you know, that's, and again, the whole thing is that,
well,
I think David said it perfectly, actually, is that the money behind these guns and these drugs are something that liberals and conservatives don't want to touch.
They don't want to talk about that.
They don't want to talk about those things.
And that gets into imperialism and what's currently going on
again,
with all the money we're spending on wars and weapons and destabilizing governments.
How can you tell people not to be violent and to not do those things over here when every Sunday on like Fox, like this Fox, watch Sunday Fox football, and they're gonna do this overseas special where they're gonna talk about them country and making sure that we're free, you know, like, you know, celebrating the wars overseas for our freedom and stuff.
Oh my God.
I mean, seriously, that's the kind of rhetoric that they're pushing out there for the public and telling them to not be violent here, but we're doing the exact opposite somewhere else, and that's our historical tradition in American culture.
Yes. And then you have people who were soldiers in those wars of imperial occupation, let's call them what they are, coming back and then getting a job as a prison guard or a cop. I mean, are you kidding? I mean, especially, I mean, you know, somebody could go through that and could be, how should I put it, reprogrammed, if you will. It's possible. But, you know, it's obvious with all the police killings, murders of unarmed citizens, what, 3 a day now, average, that obviously the ruling class is encouraging this mentality of an occupation mindset for law enforcement.
Of course.
And wanting to recruit veterans who have been in that situation.
And, of course, I'm going to plug this book as many times as I can because it's one of the best books on the current situation. David Harvey's A Brief History of Neoliberalism. And it outlines what the actual neoliberal theorists that came in that worked with Margaret Thatcher, Nixon, and Reagan, all those people, they hired these specialists that understood this idea that when to fully privatize and take care and improve the wealth of the ruling class, whenever there's any shred of democracy or resistance at the lower levels, you have to repress it, and you have to repress it violently.
Yes.
That's something that was actually in neoliberalization theory. That's something that they actually wrote and told these people.
Chile, 1973.
Yeah.
The perfect case in point. Chilean people didn't want their Social Security privatized and then end up going bust, you know.
Yeah.
New Orleans with Katrina, look at all the public schools that were immediately privatized.
They had hunt squads out there in Katrina. They had mercenary units out shooting people.
Blackwater.
Exactly. So like I said, this stuff, these are not conspiracy theories.
You know, just armed citizens keeping other people out of their area. Yeah. Remember the bridge incident?
Yes.
I can't remember what parish that was.
Well, it was going from New Orleans over to Gretna across the river.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or Algiers. I'm sorry, Algiers. Yeah. But yes, okay, I'm afraid we run out of time here. So you've been listening to the World Labor on the supported community radio station WFT in Champaign. So, Bob, you had one last thing, though?
Yeah, one of our callers said, if you want to check out how money and business and corporations get involved, he says, check out the correlation between the NRA and the National Shooting Sports Federation. That's actually the gun manufacturers lobby, and they are, say in bed with the NRA.
Gee, and, yeah, really?
So it's the gun manufacturers that are kind of pushing the NRA, which is, like you say, pretty obvious and stuff. But, yeah, you can look it up and Google the correlation between those two organizations.
Yeah. Okay. Again, you've been listening to World Labor Hour, and tune in next week. In the meantime, be safe. Power to the people. Take care.